the Northwest, we are aware of black snakes. They come through our territory. Those cars all through our lands. There is one that if it falls off the track, it will blow up and burn.
A plume of black smoke rising above the gorge.
We heard a big boom, and all the kids rushed to the windows.
We have a massive oil tanker fire. Do not travel out that way.
It's a wound into the earth, and all the little methods trying to get that wound pushed out into the world.
We've seen spills. We've seen communities fight just to get the cleanup taken care of. They don't handle their product responsibly. No matter how much they say they do, they don't.
Climate change protest is underway in Northwest Portland right now.
When our elected leaders don't listen, then we're going to take it up a notch.
The protesters have blocked the train track.
There was nothing else to do but to actually stop the oil trains.
We fully expected to be arrested. It was part of our strategy.
Being willing to go to jail for a cause makes other people realize the seriousness of it.
I stood up in front of the judge and said this needed to be done.
They're making a stand that can actually benefit people that are hundreds of miles away that may not know them.
We absolutely, as a union, understand it, that we don't want to handle this cargo.
If irresponsible decisions are continued to be made, the fulfillment of prophecies that come from Native people will come to be.
There's a point where if you don't lay down for peaceful civil disobedience, they're simply not going to listen to you.
Getting arrested and going to jail was not something I ever thought I would do, but I felt compelled to do it.
That was a clip from Necessity, a two-part documentary series on climate resistance. Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today I'm joined by an author and documentary filmmaker who is also a clinical psychologist. Among her books are Hard Knocks, Domestic Violence and the Psychology of Storytelling, and Psychiatry, Politics, and PTSD. And her films include Guilty Except for Insanity, Our Bodies, Our Doctors, and Necessity. Jan Hocken, welcome to Words and Pictures.
It's good to be here.
So, Jan, I should mention by way of full disclosure that one of the many hats you wear is commentator and interviewer on KBOO Community Radio, where this show has aired for nearly 20 years.
That's right. We are very old moles now.
Well, let's talk about Necessity. This is a two-part documentary series. 1 hour is oil, water, and climate resistance. And the second hour is climate justice and the Thin Green Line.
Yes, that's right. They're films that could be seen sequentially or they can be seen separately and don't require familiarity with the other film, but they did develop one from the other.
Yeah, let's talk about how these stories developed, how you decided after the previous films that you did on psychology and social issues, how you took this turn into the environmental justice movement and the legal system?
Well, a number of my films involve the law or legal issues, but I guess a through line, these two films are my sixth and seventh feature films, and then I've done maybe 8 or 10 short films, and they all focus on work, difficult work, carried out in the social margins, often stressful, underappreciated jobs that are vital, but often misunderstood and often stigmatized work. So whether it's abortion doctors, psychiatric care and hospitals, you know, I did one on Darcel's drag club and drag performers as engaging in a form of community therapy, helping people with their anxieties about sex and gender. And so I bring the lens of psychology also on these various jobs. So the two Necessity films are about movement work and about movement lawyers who do this difficult work of taking on corporations and figuring out how to use the legal system to navigate as we confront a greater degree of crisis around global warming. I mean, we took on the first film because there didn't seem to be much on the work of a movement and navigating this terrain, particularly around use of direct action and civil disobedience. You know, how do people come together? What are the legal issues they confront? How do they form alliances that acknowledge differences? So like my other films, it really is about a group dynamics and group forms of heroism, not individual heroes, which is often a more conventional way of thinking about the narrative structures, basic storylines that center on challenges to the hero, that the hero is tested in some way and then ultimately prevails.
Let's do a quick explainer about the necessity defense. You mentioned valve turners. Another documentary filmmaker that we've had on the show is Lindsay Graizel. She's the director of The Reluctant Radical. It's a portrait of climate activist Ken Ward, who was one of the valve turners. This was the first film where many non-lawyers learned about the necessity defense.
Yeah, it was a great film. And she consulted on my two films, and we've worked together some and contributed some footage. I think The Reluctant Radical was very much focused on the moral argument behind the necessity defense and coming to a kind of moral awareness around the need to respond to the environment, the climate crisis, and the importance of stepping in a situation where you're breaking the law, but for a reason that calls you, sometimes called the lesser of two evils.
Yeah, traditionally it would be used for, say, somebody breaking into a house to, you know, wake people up. How would you explain how it's been used in the past?
Yeah, that's a classic example, you know, where you're doing something that's normally illegal, but the act itself is of lesser harm than the threat.
Letting somebody die in a fire,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah. But I think with the necessity defense, it's been used in political trials. There's also a notion of not just entering a crisis situation to save somebody, but you're coming up against an evil threat, motivated set of dangers by the fossil fuel companies. So I think there is this aspect to it of raising the question of who is the real criminal here? Is it someone who trespasses and sits on a railroad track or turns off safety valves? Or is it these industries that are running roughshod over communities and literally poisoning the environment that we depend on? There's also the requirement that you do not contribute to the crisis or cause harm through your action. I think many people aren't aware of that as a criteria for using the necessity defense in a jury trial. But for our projects, we were really interested in the relationship between this kind of activism and indigenous communities. So both films followed these kind of parallel stories that are woven together.
You've talked about your love of storytelling, your appreciation of storytelling. And one of the features of Necessity, the documentary, is there is a story, a myth, one could say, delivered by Don Sampson, the Climate Change Project Director for the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians. And he tells this ancient Umatilla story, The Monster Who Came Up the River. And it's accompanied by animation.
Yeah, that's a story passed on like many through oral traditions where there are a number of variations. And then each storyteller who's recognized as a storyteller in their community has their own kind of vivid version. And this one we included is by Esther Motonic, Umatilla storyteller who wrote this story in the 50s. And when my team and I come into a project, I try to find stories that are meaningful locally to people. And I think that story it wasn't just a generic Native story, but one that has deep meaning for many of the confederated tribes of the Umatilla here. So then Asa Wright is a very gifted artist with the Klamath tribe here in our region. And he did his own interpretation of that story through animated series of paintings. So
he seemed to make it a bit more prophetic, the story of the monster coming up the river and swallowing up everything.
Yes, and it's also a story about the trickster character, Coyote, and I've been interested in that character in Native storytelling. There's a contest of wills in this story, and I was talking with Chief Don Sanson about this, how it's as a story, it's about the potential in all of us for greed. These oil companies are just devouring everything. So it operates as an allegory of the monstrous oil companies. But it's also about how people who are small can be quite clever and use their resources in creative ways. So it opens a section of the film on settler colonialism that sets the stage for oil by rail through the region. And I think the Coyote figure prefigures in the film this role of the creativity of people in fighting back and undermining things that are more powerful than them.
One of the comments that viewers often make about Necessity is just how compelling the photography is. I suppose that when you're making a documentary about threats to an ecosystem, it's really important to show just how beautiful the landscape is.
You know, that's such an important point. And it also came through a lot in consulting with Indigenous communities. We have two of the associate producers are Native Hawaiian and Native here Wailulupam Band. Kathy Sampson Cruz is Wailulupam Band of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. And they were emphatic about conveying a kind of love for the world and the human and the non-human habitat. And, you know, the word sacred, I'm a secular person, so I don't often use the word sacred, but I came to appreciate it more in the course of working with Indigenous communities, that idea of respect and deep, deep gratitude and appreciation for the life forms and the habitat we share. And there's a kind of humility as well as on gratitude that I felt in kind of looking at these settings through this lens. And I mean, I've done a lot of work in war zones or refugee camps and places where the beauty is more in the interesting characters and how people will hold themselves together. But this really, we really did want to have in these two films a kind of wide angle view of the region, and also to convey this idea that there's a lot to protect. And, you know, if you have this take on the climate emergency that so much has been destroyed, what's the hope we can turn these things around? I mean, there's still a lot to protect and fight for. And that's why Indigenous activists often use this term water protectors or land protectors. It's about a kind of moral responsibility to protect and care, provide certain kinds of care to each other and to the world around us. That is very antithetical to how capitalism operates as a very aggressive system.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we're talking today with Jan Hocken. She's an author and documentary filmmaker who also happens to be Professor Emeritus of Community and Clinical Psychology at Portland State University. So, Jan, let's talk about Guilty Except for Insanity. This is a film from 2010 where you spent time with patients at the Oregon State Hospital, the famous hospital for the so-called criminally insane. I say famous because it was the actual location used for the award-winning 1975 film, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah, and the producers of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest gave us rights to use clips from that as chapter headings throughout the film. You know, you were asking earlier about how you come into a situation as a documentary filmmaker when you don't know what the story is and you can't come in with a script or a rigid set about what you're looking for. You want to be open, but you have to bring something into it that makes people interested in what you're doing and willing to spend some time with you. I mean, why should people spend time with you if you don't have a reason for being there other than just observing, you know? So the question I brought to Guilty Except for Insanity was, why is it so hard to get into the psychiatric hospital, the state hospital? And then why is it so hard to get out? People were genuinely puzzled by that. And during the production of that film, there was a lot of controversy about the hospital, things in the news a lot about patients escaping and about the Psychiatric Security Review Board, people having a very hard time getting out. And that film grew out of a student project where we first went down there as like a field trip, very innocently, my group of my students with a little camera, and then it moved into a feature. And the patients were approached at Psychiatric Security Review Board hearings. I approached them in the hallway very quickly to say, would you like to be in a documentary about your experience here? You have the right legally, if your therapist agrees, to participate, because many people don't realize that the patients have the right to speak to media if their rights are protected in terms of it not affecting their treatment. So I would give this sheet quickly to patients, and then a number of them contacted me. So we went through a process of getting rights to film them also in their own environment and to have patients talk about their own analysis of the hospital, their own critique. Was it helping them? Was it more like prison? What was the difference between prison and a hospital? And so we wanted to bring out patients as well as some of the staff, their point of view of their lived experience there.
Let's talk a bit about MindZone, Therapists Behind the Front Lines. This was back in 2014 that you made this film, pretty much right in the middle of the 20-year Afghan war that the U.S. was involved in. And you're following a unit in the Army called the Combat Stress Control Unit, and they're deploying to Afghanistan. And these are clinicians, and their mission, well, there's two missions: protecting soldiers from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and also keeping those same soldiers in the fight.
Yes. And so the way I convinced the Army to do this, which is just a whole other story in and of itself, and how you have to mobilize people on your behalf. You don't just write the Army and request it. You know, you have to have a lot going for you coming into it. But I benefited in that Army was very proud of rolling out mental health services after the big peak deployment there. And, you know, a number of service members were on third, fourth, fifth deployments, and it was a pretty exhausted force. So they were providing a lot of mental health services to keep people in the fight. And there had been a literature on this, whether that's ethical for therapists to use as the criterion for if they're effective is return to duty rates. That's been true all the way back to World War I, that therapists are evaluated in terms of their effectiveness by their ability to get soldiers back online. And I was raising this question of, this has been an ethical dilemma that's been talked about in the literature, including the war literature, for over a century. And I said, wouldn't it be interesting to do a documentary on this, how clinicians in the military are managing this ethical dilemma? On the one hand, they're supposed to protect service members from mental health conditions or traumatic reactions. On the other hand, they're supposed to get them back as quickly as possible. And so I had enough support in critical places that the Army was convinced to let me and my team deploy through training and then deploy with them to Afghanistan to follow this turnover from the old unit to the new, the unit coming in. So it was a really interesting project. And I think a lot of it was a kind of a microcosm for the role of therapy in this culture in general, of overselling itself. And I think the Army and all the branches of the military were kind of overselling clinical services as the answer to keeping people in very unhealthy situations. So it was, for me, a kind of broader cautionary tale about the role of therapy in keeping people in places that are not good for them.
We mentioned that you're an author. You're the author of three books, co-editor of essays on trauma and the role of storytelling in social movements. Your most recent book is Psychiatry, Politics, and PTSD.
Yes. And this book draws on about, you know, around 200 interviews I've carried out in clinical settings or crisis settings over the last 15 to 20 years. And I became interested in PTSD as a kind of defense mechanism of the clinical field as a whole. It's a diagnosis that you can provide that or assign to people, and those symptoms often aren't very easy to differentiate from anxiety or some depressive conditions. But the main criterion is what's called an index trauma. Something has to have happened to you that would explain all of these symptoms you're having of being so troubled. So I became interested in how therapists were using PTSD to diagnose people, but also to protect them from the full condemnation and stigma associated with psychiatric diagnoses, and looking at how that category was used. And in the example I gave earlier of hospitals and the state hospital, state psychiatric hospital, and the prison, when I was filming Guilt, Except for Insanity, clinicians were using what was called trauma-informed care, which is an important progressive movement focusing on PTSD and trauma as it affected how people got into the hospital and came into their terrible situations. But it was also used to sort people into the trauma survivors, people with PTSD issues, and other patients who were thought to rightfully belong in prisons. So my book does a lot of it. It looks at the history of how trauma diagnoses have been used as a sorting mechanism. People worthy of our care versus those that aren't. And I came to see it as no longer a very progressive or helpful diagnosis, given its aim early on, coming out of the anti-war and feminist movements.
There's a sentiment that's sometimes said in jest and sometimes in deadly seriousness about the depressed and anxious people in our society these days, that there's really nothing clinically wrong with them, that they're actually exhibiting an appropriate response to a system that's gone off the rails. That might be a bit hyperbolic, but then again,
yeah, I think that in my book, this Psychiatry, Politics, and PTSD, I also tell some of the history of my own background in the anti-psychiatry movement, or what's also called critical psychiatry, where in the 1970s, for example, there was an interest in schizophrenia as a kind of revolt against the dominant social order, that in the rantings and ravings of a psychotic state, this person was refusing and exposing the irrationality of the social order. And of course, a lot of that was later seen as over-romanticizing of people and downplaying how hard it is to live with what's considered a major mental illness. But all of that was swept aside, you know, as medications became just kind of the only tool of psychiatry, basically, by the 70s and 80s. And in my early training in critical psychiatry, psychoanalysis and feminism were also important influences on me. There was a valuing of symptoms of anxiety or depressive reactions. If you're anxious or upset, it's communicative of something. It's important to listen to what your symptoms are saying. And the move in psychiatry I track over time is one of just quieting people down, not only with medications, but not kind of valuing the signal value of symptoms. And I think you're right that there's a lot of distress that's important not to identify as PTSD or trauma symptoms or as a disorder, but as forms of distress and suffering that we need to pay attention to in terms of what it's saying about the world we're living in and the madness of the system we're living under. A section in my book, I don't want to be like promoting my book, but on Timothy Leary's history of psychedelics and the experiments he ran in prisons in outside of Boston, and then how psychedelics were in this experiment, a way that inmates at this prison could set goals for themselves, be more attentive to what was going on inside of them and other people. And of course, like a lot of studies, even regular garden variety research, often there's an overinterpreting of findings. But it was so interesting reading about that history now that there's a kind of revival of that interest in that in the field of psychiatry, you know, and decriminalizing psychedelics, but also valuing the experiential aspects of these drugs after living with for decades under with drugs that are quite deadening. And a lot of people who are diagnosed major mental illnesses with psychotic symptoms don't like their drugs because they make them feel like they're dead. So I think this is a really interesting time around drugs in this culture. I'd love to come back and talk with you more about that at some point.
You've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And we've been talking today with author, documentary filmmaker, and clinical psychologist, Jan Hocken. Jan, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, I enjoyed it. Thanks so much for having me.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your work, where would they look?
Well, my work is pretty available through my website. You can see how to watch different films or order things, jhaaken.com, jhaaken.com. But this Sunday there, people can also join us at the screening, the theatrical premiere of Necessity, Climate Justice in Green Line. It'll be at the Hollywood Theater on the 17th at 3:00. And a number of the team and participants in the film will be there to discuss the film afterwards. So we hope the community turns out to see this important story.
Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter @wordsandpicture.